Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva. Alongside me is my co-host, Mr. Chad Riley.
Howdy.
How you doing today?
Doing great. How are you?
Lord above, what is that going on?
I don't know.
I'm
just feeling so patriotic.
That was very patriotic.
I'm feeling set free. I'm a free man.
I don't know what's going on with Chad, but I think he's having a stroke.
That's not funny.
No, it's not, but it's what I'm worried in. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a great show in store for you. We got a lot of things to talk about, and of course, we've got another movie to bring to your attention. So we're excited. We're stoked. We're ready to have a great time. The Filmlosophers, I got it
What's
right.
that you say?
The Filmlosophers. Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live from a small bunker near Area 51. Located in Sacramento, California, mind you.
Of course.
At VGB Studios.
It moves around.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Filmlosophers podcast and download previous episodes on your favorite platforms such as Google Play, iTunes, Player FM, Libsyn, Audioboom, or Stitcher. We also declare our Independence Day on social media. You can like and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at facebook.com/filmlosophers and twitter.com/philosophy101. And we encourage you to share your thoughts about recent movie news or even about our latest review episode. By all means, let us know what you think. Tell us, do you like the show? Do you not like the show? Be honest. I mean, we want you to be honest with us, I would say. Right?
It's true. Or if you have thoughts and opinions about the movie, we'd love to interact with you. Obviously, we get a lot of time on the mic to share our thoughts and opinions, but opinions are just that. They're opinions. It's not,
and they're our own.
Always,
they're not yours, so.
The gospel truth, the absolute truth of a situation. So we like the dialogue.
And also, too, if you have any ideas about future movies you want us to review or future movies you want us to talk about or even films from the past, let us know and drop us a word here, too. And, we'd love the dialogue with you. We're excited about the upcoming weeks. As you know, a lot of things are coming down the pipeline. We just finished a great 4th of July. And we had a chance to have Hannah Porter on the show, and that was great. And we talked about a lot of great films, but still, there are more to be talked about. There are more to be coming about, and one of the great times that happens is in San Diego Comic-Con. We're roughly a week away from the start of the biggest comic convention in the world, San Diego Comic-Con.
It is like nerd mecca.
It is. And we are excited to officially announce, I know we kind of touched on it the last time, a couple weeks ago, but we are excited to officially announce that the Filmlosophers will be present throughout the 5 days of the event. There's a lot to look forward to this year, and several new items that the convention runners will announce over the next few days. We decided a few weeks back that we were going back and forth with it. We wanted to, but we finally kind of put our hands to the grindstone and decided we're going to be there.
It's a commitment.
And it's not something you take lightly, because there is so much ground to cover while you're there. There's so many things to do. You really have to pick and choose where you want to devote your attention
to. It's interesting. Last year was my first year participating in to some degree. I did not have a badge, so I did never go into the convention hall. But if you've never been to San Diego during Comic-Con, or even if you haven't, it's been a while. I mean, there is stuff going on all over the place. Mm-hmm. Like, throughout the Gaslamp District, all up and down outside the convention hall. So it's a fun time. There are a lot of people, mm-hmm. But it's fun because you see everybody in costume and doing their own thing. There are events that go on at other venues that you mm-hmm. don't need to have a badge for. It's a much larger experience than I expected it to be before I went.
And we do have somebody here today that has been in, our fly on the wall, our official producer, Mr. Corey Vincent, host of Video Game Bang. He's actually here right now. I don't know if you can see him, which you really can't, but
I can.
I can't still, because there's this huge monitor in the way.
Hello, everybody. It's Corey Vincent
he's
here.
He's mocking me.
Oh, you can just, I would never.
You can just walk out.
Why
right
would
now.
I mock?
Now, it's a great thing to have Corey here, because one of the things that Corey has, above anything else, is experience. Corey's experience in the con life, I guess is one way to put it, is pretty vast, as he's, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, he's had several appearances on panels. He's done a lot of cons where he's covered as press, he's covered as a spectator as well, and this is not his first rodeo when it comes to San Diego. This is actually your second year of being a press. Am I wrong?
Yeah, this is the second week of being press there. I like how you put that. Con life.
There you go.
It's like thug life.
Exactly. I know. I was thinking like convention.
Yeah. No. It's all about the con life, man.
People in the con life do like to put that word in front of everything. Like mm-hmm. you have your con family. You have mm-hmm. your con flu, like which I'm just getting over right now from our time in San Diego. Or not San Diego.
Wizard World.
Yeah, from Wizard World and before that. E3 in LA. But yeah, this is going to be my second time. So excited. And like Chad nailed it on the head. Like, it takes over the entire gas lamp. Like, you do not need to have a pass to go to Comic-Con.
Not at all. I was busy for, what, 2.5 days at last year's without ever. The closest I got to the convention hall was walking up that big central staircase and looking through the glass skylights.
Yeah.
to see people milling around inside.
You were, let me in, sir, please.
I was desperate. It didn't work.
There's no excuse for, like, geeks out there not to go. Yeah. Like, the badge thing, the badge is the most boring part.
And that's the interesting thing is that every person that I've run into so far that has heard, oh, you're going to Comic-Con? Oh, that's great. You got a badge? I bet you're going to say, oh, it's so much fun. And I tell them, because of the experiences that I've heard from Corey and the experience that I've heard from Chad, I keep telling them, you don't need a badge to have a great time. One of the stories that I tell them is the Godzilla encounter that happened a few years ago mm-hmm. in promotion for the 2014, I believe, film.
For King Kong.
Yeah, for King Kong. Yeah, yeah, that one. And you didn't need to be in the con to see that. You didn't need to be in the con to experience it. It was a total outside the con experience, and it was great. It was one of the highlights of that year. So
yeah, that one they put a small group of people at a time up in a hotel room, I believe, and there were screens set up against the window. So
it was an entire bunker. It was like a whole warehouse that was designed inside to make it look like Japan, like Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And there were all these signs for, you know, warning for kaijus and whatnot. And then an alarm would go off, and they would put you in this small elevator. It looked like an elevator, and there was motion sensors on the floor that made the whole thing move, and it made it feel like you were moving up. And when it opened up on the other side, it looked like you were at the top of a skyscraper. And there was all these LCD screens, these TVs that lined the whole wall, made it look like windows outside. And the noise was deafening, they said. You could hear the roar in the distance, and all of a sudden you saw Godzilla pass by the window.
That's cool.
And that was really cool. And it's one of those things where you don't have to be inside to have experienced that. It was a total website thing. You went on the website, you signed up, you said, oh, I'm going to be here. I wasn't sure if it was a paid-for thing. I'm pretty sure it was.
But no, I don't think they had to pay for it. No. I think signed up. You had to be there at a specific time. But like last year, we did Heroes Reborn. Mm-hmm. NBC was doing a big push for that. Sadly, you know, we did the event or the interactive exhibit for that
augmented reality thing.
Yeah, where you stand in front of a screen and you are a character with powers,
wielding fire powers,
and you're shooting at things, and it's following your movement, and you know, and then you get a picture.
I actually remember that because you sent me the animated GIF when you got it.
Yeah,
and I was like, this is super cool. I want this.
It was so much cooler than that series.
I went to Comic-Con, as we've mentioned, and I was inside doing, you know, having appointments, trying to grab swag, things like that. Mm-hmm. And as I'm in there, I'm like, oh, my poor wife is just out, you know, with nothing to do. She's going to be so bored. She didn't get past. And then I'm getting tweets and pictures every 5 minutes. Now she's jumping off a building. Now she's playing mini golf with the star of, you know, this or that.
And oh, yeah. Comedy Central had the whole mini golf course. Assassin's Creed had the obstacle course thing that she did.
Yeah, she's like, now I'm getting autographs from the Impractical Jokers on True TV. And like, she just had a blast. And then,
I mean, there's free stuff all over the place on the streets. It's not just in the convention hall.
Books, like good stuff, too.
Yeah,
like
nice stuff.
Like these giant bags from Nickelodeon. Like, they had just stuff everywhere. And then when you're tired of that, you're in San Diego. You know, you have a beach day. Like,
yeah.
It's a beautiful place to go. It's an amazing event. I'm so looking forward to going back. We have a panel with Valerie Complex.
From Inquisitor?
Yep. She writes for like everybody.
She does. She has her hands in a lot of different things, but
I run into her everywhere. E3, I ran into her in the break room. Everywhere I see this lady, she's doing a panel on Thursday called Fandom Diversified. Mm-hmm. And then Aaron, also my co-host from Video Game Bang, is going to be on a panel with our good friend Janice Davis.
Oh, that's cool.
It's TBA on like the exact topic, but he's on the roster, so you can assume it's going to be very entertaining.
Yeah. And that's just to name a few of the things. I mean, some of the other things that we're looking forward to as well. Suicide Squad's going to make their appearance known there. The Justice League, you know, we're probably going to get some Batman solo film information, as we found out that Ben Affleck will be at the con. So that'll be some of the things that we look forward to.
You know what happened last year? Like, I go to Comic-Con and I'm getting messages from my family members. Oh, be sure to do this or look out for that. Like my one aunt, who's just like, Corey, I don't know where you're at, but if Ben Affleck's there, you better get me a picture, damn it. I was like, this thing's a little bit bigger than Ben Affleck.
Right.
Auntie, you might.
Also, he's going to be in like the most secluded part or sequestered part, hardest to get to.
Yeah.
I mean, they smuggle these people in. They do not announce all of the people before they're there. You kind of like, even if you're in the back of the hall and you see like the dark armored car and the person in the trench coat, you still can't tell who it is that they just smuggled into the building.
Yeah.
It's going to take a lot of schmoozing to get past those doors.
For my aunt, it was not like Comic-Con, the biggest geek convention in the world where thousands upon hundreds are there.
It was like he was at the Denny's with Ben Affleck. She's and like, he was in the booth next to
him. You were
at
that thing that Ben Affleck was at. How did you do that? She doesn't give a flip about anything I do, but when I go to a thing that Ben Affleck's at, all of a sudden she's like, oh, she wants to know more.
There you go. One of the other things that we're going to be looking forward to is obviously Benedict Cumberbatch and the rest of the crew from Doctor Strange.
Doctor Strange.
As well as James Gunn and Chris Pratt from Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Mm-hmm.
They did announce that on Facebook Live that they are planning to make an appearance at Comic-Con. Plus, they plan to be showing something from the film. They were really vague about it, but they did state.
Aren't that, they always?
Yeah, exactly. and it was Chris Pratt, and you don't know whether to take him seriously or not, because he's just that type of guy. But he's like, oh, yeah, and we're going to be showing you the film. Yeah. And that's when the
right
thing ended.
It's always interesting, too, with some of the Marvel panels in Hall H, how they've gone in previous years. You've had Robert Downey Jr. show up essentially as Tony Stark / Iron Man. He came in with his, you know, hand.
His gauntlet.
And whatever. You had Tom Hiddleston as Loki come mm-hmm. in and mock the entire hall full of people in character. I mean, I think it'd be really cool if they had even somebody you don't know yet from Doctor Strange or a new character from Guardians, somebody in costume doing their thing, you know, not just the performers on the stage.
We had a special guest on our podcast last week, Maid of Might, mm-hmm. a Sacramento cosplayer who's like blowing up. You know, she's a great person. Mm-hmm. She was at San Diego Comic-Con last year and she made it into the Star Wars panel.
And ooh, did she get to go out to the symphony?
Yep. Yeah, she saw the symphony, but I guess, and I don't remember people talking about it in this way because I was far removed, like we were probably hanging out somewhere else. But, you know, someone asked Mark Hamill a question like, so, you know, what do you think about working with, you know, Harrison Ford? And he's like, well, why don't you ask him yourself? And then Harrison Ford, surprise guest, comes out of the back and just... She said it was pandemonium. She said she started weeping uncontrollably.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Oh, my God.
It's
him.
It's Harrison Ford. Oh, my God.
I loved him in Air Force One.
He was great in Clear and Present Danger. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Some of the other things that we're also looking forward to, I mean, you got the world premiere, the announcement of the world premiere of Star Trek Beyond with a live orchestra and in the IMAX on preview night, which is Wednesday. And
it's kind of like, in a way, similar, except you have advanced notice of it, to what Star Wars did last year. I mean, Star Wars, they were in Hall H, and J.J. Abrams said, all right, everybody, we're going to go over there right now and see the symphony orchestra. I mean, and like the place where they went is right behind the hall
mm-hmm.
and is gorgeous. It's on the water. Like, it's beautiful. They walked straight out there, enjoyed the show, and this year you just kind of have advance notice that Star Trek is doing a similar thing.
And plus, with the sad recent passing a couple weeks ago of Anton Yelchin, I'm pretty sure they're going to do something
undoubtedly,
in memorial for him for that. But also, premiering at Comic-Con, you got Batman, The Killing Joke, the first rated R animated film from DC, and that'll be premiering on Friday. And I know I'm excited for that. The Killing Joke is one of my favorite graphic novels from the DC, and to really see this one fleshed out in an animated film and have the voice of Mark Hamill as the Joker, having Kevin Conroy return as the voice of Batman, and have that to see, you know, in its full entirety, not like cut here or edited there. It's actually going to be what it was meant out to be, that Alan Moore, the original creator of
How
that
early
one.
Do you plan on standing in line for that?
You know, depending on my...
Noon the day before?
Depending on my availability, it all depends. But I'm hoping really to be front and center for that one, because that one's going to be great. So one last thing that we're looking forward to also, and it's actually now become my recent obsession thanks to Corey Vincent.
You're welcome.
Conan O'Brien is actually going to be there at Comic-Con, and he's going to be filming a show every day of the week for the con. And during those showings, he's actually going to be giving away a free Conan Funko Pop that is fashioned to make like to look like a certain character in the modern culture.
Yeah, it was really cool. Last year he did the same thing, and one of the very first things that caught my eye, because I mean you can see the buildings have these giant banners on them for all the TV shows and movies and whatever that are promoting at the show. Well, Conan had his show had a huge banner on the side of the building that showed a couple of the Funko Pop, like mm-hmm. him as like a Walking Dead walker, yeah, and. Yep. And whatever, and it's just it's great for somebody of his stature to love and embrace that fandom community so much that he literally wants to be there, be a part of it the whole time.
And yeah. The good thing about him is that he's actually changed even the format of his show to kind of cater to this type of culture with his gaming segment that he now has, and how he constantly references a lot of the Marvel characters or the DC characters. He's very in touch with the now generation, I feel, and I think this is going to be a great, you know, way for him to really continue to reach out to those people.
Yeah, he dominated last year at San Diego Comic-Con, even from his arrival. Like, he arrived Mad Max style, mm-hmm. like playing the guitar on top of the thing.
Oh, that know. Is so cool.
It was like a Conan parade when he came into town.
A Conan parade?
He takes over Spreckles Theater, you know, right there in the Gas Lamp District.
Okay.
And it's the hottest ticket of San Diego Comic-Con, easily. Those pop vinyls are one of the most collectible pieces of swag available.
Yeah,
like he gives it to free to every audience member, and you just see people slanging them on the streets. Like,
oh
when
yeah,
you're walking
yeah.
around, people like trying to sell those pop vinyls. Like when the pandemonium's going on, they're going for $500+ yeah. dollars for the collection. It's just ridiculous. The guy knows how to market himself. He's been making money in this space. Like mm-hmm. even his Clueless Gamer.
Yeah, that's what
segments.
I was saying.
Yeah, they just.
Well, and he's even had people like PewDiePie, who's a YouTuber, Markiplier, who's a YouTuber. Yeah. He's really trying to get to know the generation of this type of you know, mindset, and I think he's doing a good job, especially with making an appearance like that at Comic-Con. So as we continue to draw closer to Comic-Con, we'll continue to let you know more and more of what we know, and of course, we'll tell you all about what we hear. But that actually brings us to our special segment of the day, which is a review of a film that we had high hopes for. We actually came in hoping, you know what, this is going to be good. The first one was a great film, and you know what, this one's going to do just as well. Same director, same kind of chemistry, I guess you could say, that made the first one so great.
Yeah, the general story makeup is very similar.
But sadly, it kind of fell a little short. We are talking about Independence Day Resurgence, the film that is the sequel to the film that had that iconic speech that everybody knows.
That you can hear right
that
now.
That you can actually hear right now, because we felt, what would be the best way to let people know we're reviewing Independence Day? And this just seemed to fit.
I mean, I'm like, why are you talking right now, Eddie? I mean, this speech...
I'm torn from continuing.
I still sometimes, if I haven't watched the movie in a while or whatever, if I hear this speech just, I don't know, randomly from somewhere, I still will get some chills.
I'm not kidding. I was like 12 or 13 at a time. After I heard that speech, I'm like, where can I enlist? I want to join this man's army. I don't know where he hails from, but I will serve this guy. I mean, it was just such a heart, you know, pulling a heart, you know, heartstring pulling type of speech that just draws that American patriotism right out of you. And I'm like, I want to do it. I want to do that army. I want to go to that army and be a part of that. And I couldn't because I was only small. I was like a little kid.
Well, and, you know, we weren't actually being invaded by aliens who were, you know, destroying all of our major cities and all of that. It was, that was in the movies, Eddie.
Yeah, it was in the movie. I mean, I live in that world. I'm sorry.
I understand. I feel your pain. But, yeah, the first movie was a true standout. I mean, yes, it's a popcorn disaster flick, you know, but Roland Emmerich as a brand developed from there.
Yeah.
Essentially. That was the first drop in the bucket. It was very unique feeling at the time that it came out, and it still really stands up in comparison to his other films. I think it's still the best, personally. Maybe that's just because of that kind of emotional connection you have from experiencing that film for the first time in the theater. But, man, that speech. And this movie makes every effort to make sure that it connects to that speech. It is the first thing that you hear, essentially. You hear little glimmers of the speech in the opening credits. It comes up a couple of times throughout the film. I don't know that this film really lives up to the glory of that moment.
Yeah, we are talking about Independence Day Resurgence, the sequel to the 1996 hit Independence Day. Directed by Roland Emmerich, this film stars Liam Hemsworth, Jeff Goldblum, Bill Pullman, Micah Monroe, and Jesse T. Usher. The synopsis goes, after Independence Day redefined the event movie genre, the next epic chapter delivers global spectacle on an unimaginable scale. Using recovered alien technology, the nations of Earth have collaborated on an immense defense program to protect a planet, but nothing can prepare us for the aliens' advanced and unprecedented force. Only the ingenuity of a few brave men and women can bring our world back from the brink of extinction.
Okay, so it goes without saying that there are spoilers contained in this conversation. It's been a couple weeks since the movie came out, so it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody.
This is our post, you know, 4th of July, Independence Day kind of deal. We spend our time talking about patriotism and whatnot. Now we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the film that's supposed to carry on that legacy.
So undoubtedly, if you really wanted to see it, you've already seen it along with 12 other people. And if
sadly,
you didn't
we
really want to see
people.
It, then
we were one of the 12.
That's true. This is one that we actually paid for. Usually we get, you know, press screening options and whatnot. But I was really excited for this movie. I mean, you take a property like Independence Day, which kind of modernized what used to be a B-movie genre. You know, these disaster event films. It was those, they've always been B movies. Independence Day, it was just, there was the right mix of chemistry and unique, quippy dialogue and the practical effects that also had some digital animated components. I mean, it all just, to me, I was a child at the time, like you were, it just worked. You know, it worked. And now you've got 20 years later. Here you are, finally, after 20 years, they have the perfect story to bring it back. The stakes are higher. There are a few more / new characters. And here you go. And we were really excited to see it.
We were.
Not as excited walking out of the theater as we had been when we walked in.
And it's interesting that you say the right mix of characters in the right, you know, in the right way of the first film. Because, I mean, you had people who weren't really considered heavy hitters at the time. You had Will Smith.
The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, who probably at the time had maybe one or two film appearances at the most. I would say probably two, maybe one. The only one I can think about is an early 90s film that he did. But outside of that, he wasn't really known for anything other than Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And you put him in on screen with the likes of somebody like Jeff Goldblum, and you have just a great chemistry of hilarity. You have that going back and forth of Jeff Goldblum's character, David Levinson, as this ingenious scientist who is trying to figure out what's going on, and his neurotic behavior and mannerisms really play well on Will Smith's just bravado and confidence. And because Will Smith was not able to bring about his character from the previous film, he wasn't able to return for the film.
He's not in this film. His likeness is there's a painting in the White House,
which is really awkward
with him in it, with of his character. But he does not make an appearance in the film.
No, and that's one of the idea of the fact that you're now having to make up for what was lightning in a bottle for the first film. It just. You're trying too hard to make the same kind of humor work amongst several people instead of just one person who had all that at the same time. You have Liam Hemsworth's character, who is this pilot who was pretty much chastised and sent to work on the moon.
Yeah, he was a little too cocky in a training exercise. His actions led to the almost death of one of the other main characters, who is the son of Will Smith's character from the first film. And so because of his rash behavior, he's in a way been demoted and sentenced to operating a space tug, a tugboat in space, on this new base on the moon.
Yeah. And as Chad said, apparently it's implied that before that, Will Smith's character, who was Captain Hiller, his son Dylan and the character Liam Hemsworth plays, Jake Morrison, they were friends. They were all buddies at the same time, alongside with Bill Pullman, the president, President Whitmore's daughter, Patty.
She grew up and became a fighter pilot for a time as well, and they were all buddies in the academy.
Yeah, and then, like Chad said, during training of sorts or whatnot, Jake almost kills Dylan and gets reprimanded and sent off. And so that's kind of how you start the film. You're coming into the film establishing the relationships between these characters. Like Chad said, I didn't get why the picture was up in the White House. I mean,
let's be honest, the reason that's given for the fact that Will Smith is not in this movie,
which I feel was stupid, mind you. I mean, that it's a little bit strong, but I just go ahead.
The reason that's given is that he Will Smith's character died in a training accident.
The most decorated pilot.
Totally off screen, right?
Off screen. The most decorated pilot, the man who
figured out how to fly one of their ridiculous
fighter spacecraft,
ships, right?
And was able to leave the spacecraft at like breakneck speeds, outrun a atomic bomb, a nuclear warhead that goes off on the mothership. He was able to outrun that. He was able to crash land the ship to where they could still survive, him and David Levinson, and walk out of there, and he dies in a training accident, training with the same equipment that he was the first one to touch. I didn't get that. I was like, that is such a cop out.
It's one of those things that feels it's hard to
it was ridiculous.
Just take a guess at things that happen behind the scenes. Allegedly, his shooting schedule for Suicide Squad and maybe another movie interfered with what they wanted from him for Independence Day, and so he wasn't able to commit to the film, and they had to remove his character. But it kind of in a meta sense, it seems to indicate that it was not necessarily an amicable decision.
No.
Because why else would you give such a great character such a lame off-screen death?
It's unwarranted, because if from what we've heard, if there was such a great rapport between the production company and Will Smith as far as the inability to, return for his role, then you would have figured, okay, maybe something else would have happened, or even had him see if he could come back for a day, or something more dignified than just, oh yeah, the dude was like, oh, do I hit this switch and hit the other switch and blew up. That's what I felt ultimately.
Right, that's the impression you're left with, is that it was this small incident that ended up killing the main character. And you may be thinking, if you haven't seen the movie yet, and you want to, you may be thinking, well, if he's not in the movie, then why are these guys spending so much time talking about him? And I think
that it was the best part of the
episode. If you have seen the movie, then you would agree that he's the only thing that you should talk about for a while, because this movie doesn't have somebody like him, whether or not it was actually Will Smith as a performer.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, people knew him as the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. His role in the original film was a revelation.
Yeah.
His ability to carry a film of that stature, of that budget, with that subject matter, that was a revelation of him as a performer. And it was a lightning in a bottle kind of moment where everyone was very pleasantly surprised, and his career took off from there. I mean, he's a totally verified a dozen times over, like, lead movie star actor, because not all actors can do that. And this movie happens to not have any actors that can do that. I mean, you've got Jeff Goldblum. He's got a lot of experience playing essentially different facets of the same character. David Levinson, Ian Malcolm, a few others, they're kind of all the same. He has that kind of trademark neurotic shtick that he does regularly. Yeah. And he's totally fine. You know what to expect. You know how to expect it. And he delivers right on the line, right on the mark. There's nothing unexpected or particularly special in a surprising kind of way from him. And there's nobody else who really qualifies as a standout performer in this movie. They kind of distribute the weight over several different characters, none of whom is individually important enough to be the Will Smith of this revived property.
I mean, we do have Gail. Gail does try admirably to pick up that mantle.
Liam Hemsworth, whose character's name is Jake.
Little Thor.
People know him from the Hunger Games movies, right?
Thor's little brother. He tries to really be that that type of humorous character in the film. He really does admirably. He does try, but it's not the same. Really, it isn't, and unfortunately what you get are dry humor. You leave with the sense of dry humor, jokes that fall flat, almost whole shticks that are supposed to happen and end successfully with, you know, the audience laughing, left more of the audience just scratching their heads, wondering, wait, was that a joke?
So Will Smith, his character in the first one just had kind of a smart aleck, sassy, quippy kind of personality. Like, it was from the very beginning. I mean, the movie opens and he's like going to the bathroom and then goes outside to see a giant alien spaceship hovering over Los Angeles. So right there you've established, you know, he kind of has a no-nonsense, like, I am what I am, you know, whatever. And in this movie, the way that they try to incorporate the bravado and the humor and everything, they have several characters who just like randomly will drop a one-liner that's supposed to be funny. Mm-hmm. That's not really organic to the scene that they're doing or the moment in the scene. It's literally, you sit there as an audience member thinking they wrote that line in order to add a dose of humor to the scene. Not because it made sense to the characters in the scene, but just because they wanted to make sure that the audience wasn't going to too serious of a place.
Yeah. And I think the heaviest part of that disappointment does fall on Jesse T. Usher's character, Dylan Hiller, who is supposed to be the one who carries that mantle forward. And you probably get maybe a total of 20 minutes screen time with him in total, but maybe 5 of that is him actually having a solid dialogue.
Doing something useful.
Exactly. If he's not trying to punch somebody, or if he's not trying to mean mug somebody, or if he's not trying to give a very unheartfelt speech to soldiers or whatnot. Because, I mean, let's face it, with the one speech that they gave in Independence Day, they tried to amp that up by making 3 to 4 different speeches that all reference the same speech, including Bill Pullman returning
Know what gave everybody the feels in the first movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it was that speech.
It was that speech. And everybody else's speech just fell flat. From the president's speech, the president played by Celia Ward, which kind of seemed a little hokey and whatnot, to Captain Dylan Hiller's speech to his team as they go out for their first encounter with the aliens. That falls flat. It's very very cold, almost, because it's like, I see what you're trying to do, but I'm not feeling it, you know. And you have Bill Pullman try to rebring that whole, you know, let me, you know, lead us to Independence Day or whatever. You don't get that from him this time around. And maybe it is possibly due to older age. And, you know, things happen as you get older and whatnot. And Bill Pullman really looks old in this film. Like, I don't know if that was intended, but the man...
Oh, I think they fully intended to make him look the way that he looked. But you know me, I'm a story guy. I like writing scripts in my spare time when I feel like I have it. And I like analyzing story, and it would be one thing. There are some people that are, you know, giving many of the performers flack for being wooden, cardboard, one-dimensional, you know, and everything. And while that is true, the performers overall, there are very few that stand out as like great, noticeable performers. And that's not to say that they're terrible and they don't know how to deliver a line, but they don't know how to make it sing.
Yeah.
They don't know how to put that extra dose of something into it. But certainly the script did not do them any favors because the dialogue is extremely basic. I mean, it's like character A says they might come back. Character B says a spaceship just appeared on our radar. Character A says they came back. You know, like, I mean, it is that bad in several of the scenes.
It is.
And when you're given that kind of content to work with, not only the lines of dialogue, but the way the story progresses is extremely formulaic and basic. They kind of try to take elements that they felt worked from the first movie and then recreate them in this movie, but with a bigger problem, right? And it just it falls flat because it's not as developed. After 20 years of waiting, this story is probably, I would say, about 60% as developed as the original movie. The original movie was a much more developed story on paper before they even started filming. And then you have what the actors, the performers, were able to inject into their roles in the first movie.
Now, we do have recurring roles with certain actors and actresses. You have Jeff Goldblum, as we stated, reprises his role as Dr. David Levinson.
Mm-hmm.
We have Bill Pullman, who reprises his role as ex-President Whitmore, who has now turned cuckoo, apparently. And
well, he was affected because, you know, he got in his head and, you know, showed him that they were here to consume the world.
Let's face it, they laid the cuckoo on pretty thick. Like, they made it to where he was really, even he was starting to think, yeah, everybody thinks I'm crazy. I'm a crazy old Whitmore or whatever kind of deal. I was waiting for him to start waving, like, his, you know, cane at people and, you kids, get off of my lawn kind of deal.
Well, he kind of did come up and, like, step all over Cecil Ward's moment in front of, like, the cameras of the whole world to let everybody know that the aliens coming. Are coming back.
They're coming. you got Brent Spiner, I thought was an enjoyable reprisal for me because he was honestly probably the most humorous thing of the whole film. He added more of the comedic value that lend itself to the first film from his character specifically back into this film. Now,
well, here's the thing. In the first film, he definitely was like one of the comic relief elements of the story. I mean, yeah, he's a brilliant scientist and he kind of vibes with the aliens somehow and he understands what's going on with them, but I mean, he's been shut in at Area 51 for who knows how long in the first movie.
He was
right?
also affected just like the president because I don't know if you remember, he's the first one that gets the thing around his neck to speak to.
Yeah, and I'm speaking about the first movie before that happens.
Oh, okay.
Like as an element of the plot, his character is a comic relief character. It's a pressure release, if you will. And then yes, he was kind of the alien spoke through him, and then you learn in this movie that he's been in a coma for the entire 20 years between the first movie and this one. He looks exactly the same. And what was acceptable sparingly in the first movie is way overused in this movie. Like, he's one of the main characters of this movie, and I walked out of the theater not knowing why. Like, I don't understand why they spent so much time on him because
he was the only thing that was good. I'm sorry, but there wasn't anything.
I didn't think he was good. I didn't think he was good in the first one, and I certainly didn't think that he was good enough to carry so many minutes of screen time in this one. He's good in small doses, but then we got overdosed with, I don't even remember his name, Dr. Occam or something, Occam's Razor.
Dr. Occam.
It's something like that. But, you know, and his decision making is very poor. Like, he's one of those leap before looking non-scientific scientists, which, you know, it's just the whole thing to me didn't make very much sense with him getting so much screen time. They gave him a subplot, which is fine. And, you know, it's just, there's a lot in this movie.
They made a statement that he was homosexual in the film, apparently, that he had a relationship with another,
with his like assistant person who's also male, roughly the same age, who I don't remember from the first movie, but it's been a while since I've seen it.
I do remember him being the assistant in the first one, but not, he didn't have such a prevalent role in the first one to stand out, but he stuck with him all these years, apparently, so
yeah, gives him flowers while he's laying there in his coma. And you know, but It's one of those like of
fly
all,
on the walls giving me dirty
of
looks
all
over
the
there.
Things that you could choose to develop for this story.
Yeah,
that was not the right thing in my opinion. That was not the right thing to develop, was to give him more screen time and have him go kooky all over the place.
Yeah,
because you have a lot of other elements of the plot that should have been developed that weren't.
Mm.
Like there's an entire African country that has been fighting the aliens for 20 years because one of the ships successfully landed in that country. It didn't crash. It wasn't shot down. And the aliens inside streamed out and for 20 years almost had been trying to kill all the people of this country. And so the people of this country have partially learned how to speak and understand their written language,
mm-hmm.
Have learned good methods to penetrate their body armor and kill the alien inside. Because if you remember from the first movie, you've got kind of the alien is kind of small.
And you have an exoskeleton.
You've got the exoskeleton that's the big warrior. You know, Will Smith punches it in the face and drags it around in a parachute and everything. And so these people in the African country, they've learned, they've been changed. They've been psychologically and culturally changed because they've been in this long-term ground war with the aliens with not a lot of help from the outside world, and they know things that other people don't know, but you don't have time to develop that because you're watching kooky, funny scientist guy come out of a coma and sort of kind of know some of those same things because he was once possessed by one of them.
I don't know. I still stand by. The reason, I think the only reason why it was given so much time and given so much effort into creating a subplot to the main storyline as far as what he does and how he does it was because of the fact that he probably was the only he honestly was one of the only returning actors who could still probably do what he did in the first film. Who knows? Needless to say, yes, it was an excess, but it for me it was slightly enjoyable. But all in all, the film as it progresses, you do hit those same bumps of your formulaic disaster alien, you know, infestation or invasion kind of deal with aliens plot where you have them go out, they try the first time, they fail horribly, the aliens come back stronger with another plot, do some heavy damage, they rile everybody up, they go out again, you have them try to go for another attack and they also fail again and the team is downtrodden and whatnot, and they do the whole, you know, we did it before, we can do it again kind of deal. Realize that they have to. Oh, I'm sorry. We haven't even mentioned the giant, you know, hamster ball that rolls around the entire place.
Right.
The
first alien that pops up in our solar system turns out to not be one of them.
It's a giant Death Star. That's not a Death Star, but it comes and as true Americans, what do? We shoot first, ask questions later.
Shoot it out of the sky.
They shoot it out of the sky, and apparently it held this ball of glory that speaks to humans, and they're like, but
yeah, it's this other race of aliens that millennia ago transcended physical bodies and became digital beings, and so this orb now holds the last remaining essence of this race that's apparently been in a war with the aliens that we're familiar with the big ships that shoot green fire and blow up cities, or plasma, excuse me, sorry.
Whatever.
Plasma.
Whatever.
And so this is the last remaining, essentially, hero in the universe
mm-hmm.
who has come early to warn and try to save Earth, and we, like, almost kill it ourselves.
We ultimately destroy its
and
arc.
You know, incapacitate it, right, from actually helping.
Yeah, because the idea was that the orb was going to make its way to Earth so that they could save as many as possible and then take them to the place where, you know, they're at. So that whole subplot also is just kind of a wash for me. It's kind of like a cop-out to say, oh, by the way, we got this ace in the hole. Check it out. And, you know, I just, because the mother alien, whatever her name is, she's trying to find this orb.
Yeah, they have a queen. They're like a hive.
Yes.
And she's huge.
And she is huge. And her whole point is to destroy that orb to find the information as to where the last location is so that she can go and destroy it. So that kind of changes gears. It no longer becomes an invasion story, but it's now a take back something that is valuable to me kind of deal. And
yeah, they changed a lot about the motivations of our enemy aliens that we know from the first one. Because from the first one, what President Whitmore learned is that they are here to consume all of our resources, right? Mm-hmm. In this one, suddenly, they are pursuing the last member of a dying race that they've been at war at for millennia and getting vengeance for the fact that we beat them 20 years ago. And they don't want all of our resources. They just want to carve the molten core out of the center of the planet and then leave.
Yeah, because apparently that powers their huge heavy ships and whatnot. And for whatever reasons, it's...
And they have to go to inhabited planets to do this for reasons unknown. Although, when they have, like, other giant, you know, Jupiter-like planets that they can't take resources from.
They literally pass by all these different planets to get to ours. You know, and it you're right, it does it's change the odd. Dynamic of the entire essence of the first film to this one. So... Like I said, all it was just that ace in the hole kind of deal where they're like, oh, well, you know, by the way, we also have this. Oh, looks like the queen wants this. Uh-oh, what are we going to do? And so Bill Pullman, you know, spoiler alert, Bill Pullman decides to pilot one of these ships, and he carries a transmitter that apparently can mimic the frequency of the orb and have the mothership intercept this orb decoy, which is holding these missiles that'll essentially blow up on command.
Yeah, so one of the things that we kind of alluded to in the beginning of our review that's a big part of the story is that humans, for the last 20 years, have been reverse engineering the alien technology. Mm-hmm. So we have laser guns and plasma, whatever, we have armaments that they actually incapacitate rather quickly when they arrive. And so we have essentially like souped up nuclear warheads.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to take out the queen because she has put on her own armor. She's huge. She's the size of a building. And she's got her own armor on and she is pursuing.
She's a big mother.
Yes, she is. She's got a small swarm of fighter ships around her, but she's pursuing what she believes to be the orb. Leads to the most laughable part of a movie really that had a lot of laughable parts.
It did.
But essentially, she catches the ship mm-hmm. that Bill Pullman's, you know, former President Whitmore is piloting. He sets off these nuclear weapons. They think they've killed her. They haven't. She has a personal shield on her armor that is stronger than all those weapons. And she now knows that it wasn't actually the orb. So what does she do? She actually goes running back to Area 51, where the orb actually is, where idiot scientist Brent Spiner has activated it again so that its transponder is once again transmitting and attracting everybody to it. She goes to get it.
Mm-hmm.
No, she doesn't, because she sees a school bus full of children in the desert near all these bombs and decides to chase them for 20 minutes instead.
And you're probably wondering, isn't Jeff Goldblum's dad in the film?
I sure wasn't wanting to wonder that.
Actually, he is. Let me tell you, Judd Hirsch does reprise his role, and there's no point for it. It's one of those times where you're looking at it, and you just wish, sadly, won't this character die?
Because he would have had a very meaningful death if they had ended his arc at that moment, but they decided to make him the new Randy Quaid, in a way.
And so he appears with a school bus full of children at the exact place where his son is at doing this whole experiment to keep the explosion from, you know, blowing up everything else. And as Chad said, the queen sees them, sees the bus, decides, oh, I'm going to get these guys because they're closest to me, I guess. And they're probably, I don't know, holding the orb in their pocket or something. And decides to go after the bus. Yeah.
For a long time.
For a very long time.
For, like, several minutes.
You could have put that sound, that one song, that whole, you know, thing.
I can't wait to see the honest trailer for this film.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense. So, ultimately, Bill Pullman's daughter, Patty Whitmore, who jumps back into a fighter plane, is able to pierce the shield that's surrounding the queen. They bring in the other people who have been hiding, you know, in the mothership or whatever. They've commandeered alien, you know, ships, and they've come in, and they're coming to destroy the queen. A whole chasing ensues, ultimately killing the queen. I mean, let's just face it, they kill him, and that's the end of it. So
interestingly enough, the queen does I guess, hear or perceive the transponder of the orb again, goes after, attacks Area 51, punches through, actually catches the orb and has it and is going to destroy it, and then ultimately some of our other heroes find a way to defeat her before she can destroy the orb, so the orb is now safe again.
Now, do you remember that ace in the hole we talked about? Here's where the ace in the hole comes into play. That orb apparently now decides that even though she called humanity primitive, she realizes, because it's a female voice in the orb, she realizes, oh, wait, you guys aren't primitive. You guys are actually cool, pretty cool. I'll tell you what, you guys can actually lead our army as we face off against the other people. Let's team up. And it becomes this whole Power Rangers kind of deal, like everybody's given now these, you know, the opportunity to go out into space and now destroy other aliens, and Liam Hemsworth is like, all right, when can we leave kind of deal, the whole cowboy gung-ho thing.
Oh, yeah, it's totally like now transitioning into Starship Troopers.
Yeah, so all in all, the film kind of was a dud for me, and this is kind of where we come to the point of our show where we have to talk about how many monocles and does it pass or fail? I can go first if you want.
Do it.
I give it probably a monocle and a half. Because I didn't...
You're so generous.
I just didn't like it, but I mean, you have to give it props for trying to make a sequel, but as a film altogether, I fail it horribly. Mm-hmm.
I was sitting here thinking while you were talking, and I was like, you know, they do use audio from that speech from the first movie like three or four times in this film.
Is that the only thing that's going to give it a monocle?
That gives it a monocle.
So it's going to give it one.
Yeah. The graphics are decent. The basic story elements are there, but they're not special.
The graphics were great in After Earth, too, but I didn't want to see that garbage again.
It's kind of like I have not returned for a high school reunion in my personal life. So, but it's kind of the part of my brain that says, you know, do I want to spend the money on the airfare and outfit and whatever that would be involved in going back and reconnecting with friends from high school and you know, acquaintances and whatever. And that fear that if I spend the money to do it and I go after 20 years and see everybody and see everything, that it's gonna like lack some of the specialness that's associated with the memories from my time in high school. That exact feeling is what I walked out of the movie theater with after this film. It's been 20 years. They've had all the time in the world. They had like 8 people listed as working on the story and script for this movie.
Yeah.
Right? There's no excuse for it to be as bad as it is. Because the graphics are more than passable.
Yeah, yeah.
The story makes some stupid choices.
A lot,
That could have been avoided with 20 years of preparation time. So it's that feeling of like, I spent money on this, and it lacked the specialness of what I was wanting from the experience that I had with it before. You know, it's like a bad reunion.
So does it pass or fail for you?
Fail.
Fail.
Gets an F.
Well, tell you what, the only
thing... Gets a D minus because they did use the speech a few times.
Bootsy. The only thing you can really do after this is, you know, let's play a game.
Woohoo!
Will it genre? As you can see, the film obviously fell a bit short for us. And, you know, it fell a bit short for us where we felt a true sequel should have landed. Here in the Filmosophers, you know, we have to take a step back and wonder, maybe, just maybe, could it have been the genre as a whole that took that misstep for the sequel? We ask the question, would the sequel have succeeded if, say, it was a different genre? Let's get into...
I'm loving this already. Better than the movie.
Let's get into Will It Genre? So we're going to ask the simple questions as we've done before. We're going to talk about it, but this is the unique take we're going to do. We're going to take the film as a whole, the sequel aspect of the film. Not the, you know, everything
individual
that happened.
Story components.
No, no,
yeah.
No. All that garbage can go back where it belongs. We're going to take the sequel as the component and use that as the point of our question. Will it genre in this one? Will it genre in this
will
one?
Will it work in a different genre?
Yeah.
So, obviously, you can tell by this point in the podcast that for us, the disaster event movie, alien invasion movie genre, if that's a thing, didn't work.
Nope.
Nope.
So would it work if it was changed? We know that the first one was a disaster event movie, alien invasion movie. So we're being a bit facetious here. But Eddie,
we're going to have some fun. That's all I'm saying.
What do you think? Would this have worked if for the sequel they did it as a rom-com?
As a rom-com. Will Smith, Vivica A. Fox. I just... Maybe. You know what? Had Will Smith returned for his role, easily I would have said yes.
Well, if Will Smith had returned for his role...
The film would have succeeded.
It would have worked as an event disaster movie with an alien invasion.
No.
What if it was a rom-com between the alien hive queen...
What are we, Mork and Mindy here?
And the orb was a masculine presence instead of a feminine presence, and it was really just a mistaken... It was like jilted lovers.
Eva?
That's a pretty intense and gnarly-looking Eva, by the way, that queen.
No, I was talking about the orb.
No, I said the queen is the queen. The queen is the queen. So the orb would be, like, you know, more masculine. Because, really, they...
The orb would be masculine.
The orb had, like, a little girl, like a child girl's voice. As if it was young and underdeveloped.
How you doing, mama? I can see it now working.
See? See, rom-com. See, it's just, it's mistaken identity. It's a whole Shakespearean funny thing.
Yeah, they're doing
right?
a whole Romeo and Juliet.
They happen to blow up worlds because they're having a lover's spat.
One's from the side that wants to decimate their entire planet. Yeah. Yeah, I could tell
Very
you what.
Romeo and Juliet, but...
I could see it. I could
as a comedy instead of a tragedy?
I would see it then. Yeah, maybe as that. What about you?
I mean, it would be better than what we got.
I think all of these are going to be better than
no,
what we
No, I don't
had.
Know. It would be pretty awful. That would be pretty terrible.
You know, I got some imagination. I could see it working.
Interesting.
Let me ask you this. Okay, then how about this? Will it genre as a Western? Now, we've already had Cowboys and Aliens.
I know. I was
out.
Just thinking Cowboys and Aliens did not work for me.
It didn't?
You
didn't?
No, it did not.
Harrison Ford?
I love all the performers, and I really wanted to like the movie, but I don't even remember the specifics of it because it so didn't work for me.
That's a good point.
It was... I just remember it was... it wasn't anything
it has
special.
It confounded you. I can see it's...
I don't even remember any particulars except for Daniel Craig had that... It was embedded on his arm, and he could shoot alien laser pulses instead of just like a six shooter. And that's literally the only thing I... Oh, and people got like zapped away on leashes or something.
Yep.
They got like sucked up really fast. But that was all in the trailer.
Got that
so
out of
there
War
was
of
nothing
the
within the movie that expanded on the trailer in a meaningful way. If I can see everything that's worth seeing in a minute and a half in a trailer, then you shouldn't have made that movie.
That's true. So does it work for you?
A Western for this one? Gosh, that would be really funny if they went back in time. Like, if the aliens, as part of their invasion plan, they actually had time travel, and they're like, well, they defeated us in 1996, so let's go back to...
1866. Something like that.
I don't know. It could work. They certainly would have won.
I could possibly see it working, if that's the dynamic of it, if it goes in that direction. But I don't know if I'm willing to visualize a xenomorph with a cowboy hat just yet. So
yeah, no.
Yeah,
that'd be funny to watch, though.
Let me ask you this one. How about this? And this seems more in the vein of possibility, but will it genre as a conspiracy thriller?
Conspiracy thriller in the sense of like, how deep does the corruption go? Somebody from our side signaled them to come back?
Maybe. I mean,
think that would have worked a lot better than what we got.
Because what my mind runs to when I think of this...
Because humanity was all on the same side, but they were all stupid in this movie.
They were. What my mind really runs to when it comes to when I think of this is X-Files.
Yes.
Because X-Files really digs deep into the conspiracy theory of the government and whatnot. And knowing the success of that series... I actually would say, yeah, I think it would work. I think
it definitely would have been a more compelling story than what we got, yeah.
You know, even if you can bring back Mulder and Scully, that'd be great.
Well, I don't know about the mashup.
I know. Darn it. Well, okay, here's the last one. This is the last one we have on the list. Will it genre as an animated film? Now, that's not to say that it has to be tied to one specific, name as far as like Disney or DreamWorks or Illuminations or whomever it may be. just as an animated film. You know, keeping in mind.
See, if it was a truly standalone story not connected to 1996 Independence Day, it might have a chance as a really well done, like fully CGI animated film. However, one of the things that I loved the best about Independence Day was what felt like the practical effects. So they actually built miniatures of the cities that got destroyed, and they blew them up.
That is true.
It wasn't computer animated destruction. They were models of the buildings and everything with actual explosives, and that added an element of, for me as a kid, terror. Like, that was terrifying to see the first time. That wall of fire
as it's coming down the city.
And I think that if you went from that to a sequel that was all animated, you would have lost something. Although, having said that, I think that they really did computer animate all the destruction in this one, so they still lost it.
Yeah.
As it is.
I wouldn't dare even touch it with a 10-foot pole as an animated film. I just, for me, when you talk about alien invasion type films, when you talk about that sci-fi genre, it just becomes so diluted if it goes into any other thing. When it comes to animation seems to remove any sense of fear or dread out of anything.
Yeah.
And for me, that's what you get out of a sci-fi thriller. That's what you get out of an alien invasion film. And with this particular one, with the direction they went to, Well, that about wraps up our show today for you. And, of course, we want to leave you with a little bit of information. We're not so much going to leave with you with Movie Bites, but we want to talk a bit real quick and let you know about some more information for Comic-Con. So we will be posting live from San Diego Comic-Con on all our social media pages. So make sure to like and follow us on all of them as well, twitter.com/filmlosophy101 and facebook.com/filmlosophers. Make sure you take a look at it daily. We're going to try to post as much as we can while we're there.
It's hard to do while you're working, but I mean, we are kind of in the middle of everything.
We are. And like I said,
if you can't be there, we can be there for you.
Exactly. And you know what? If there's things that you want us to check out, or if you have any suggestions, if you heard something, let us know. Drop us a line on our comment page, or let us know on our Twitter page and tell us, hey, I hear so-and-so is going to be there. I hear this is going on. We'd love to get your input as far as the direction of where we go once we're there. So we will also be recording an episode live at the con. So stay tuned for more details about when you can hear our coverage and immediate reactions to news from Hall H and other venues in the area. We are going to try to, like I said, bring the information to you as frequent as possible and as current as possible. And like I said, we're excited because we're going to be actually recording there. So that's a pretty exciting
thing
for us.
Right there in the thick of it all.
So
costumes and everything. No, we're not wearing costumes.
I'm not wearing a costume. Don't even look at me. I think Corey Vincent was going to be going as a brony. That's all I heard. So again, thanks for listening.
I say nay.
Thanks again for listening. And of course, if you have anything to add or if you have any comments about the show, drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. As always, you know, thanks for listening. And I am Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.